Well, introducing Bette Davis and Ken Johnson is sort of like old home week. Betty and Ken have worked with us a lot in our innovation section. Betty is been a midwife for about 30 years and has worked both internationally and specifically on problems in Canada. But she's been very involved in trying to get the statistics together to prove what out-of-hospital birth and specifically home birth can offer to mothers and babies in this time. And her husband, Ken Johnson, is actually the senior epidemiologist at the Public Health Agency in Canada, where he sort of divides his time to as much cancer work as he does perinatal work. And I'm not sure exactly what you all are presenting on today, so I turn the microphone over to you for excitement.
Let me see what comes up in the slides.
Yeah, whatever.
How many of you were at the presentation earlier at 2:30? So a few of you, okay. How many of you are familiar with the home birth study that we published in 2005? It was a major home birth study. All right. Those of you who are there any physicians in the room? Okay. I'm doing my. Who am I speaking to? Okay, we intend to offend.
Damage
no.
control, right? Damage control.
I'm just curious. All right, so I'll go ahead here. The other thing you need to know, of course, is that Ken and I are kind of attached at the hip. We tend to present together and tend to try to not to overimpose on each other. Just as a midwife, an epidemiologist should. I wanted to say also that every time we do another piece of research, we find that, oh my God, we've got to do another piece of research to figure out what is happening now. And this is a very good example, this thing that has occurred with us recently. Okay, so we're going to talk a little bit about, this is the overview of this afternoon. We're going to talk a little bit about the home birth research. We will try to get through that fairly quickly. And we're going to do a little bit about the critiques of the study that we've published in 2005. And we're going to talk about this neonatal mortality comparison and the prematurity factor because it's very interesting. These are the little nuances that are coming out of our database now. And we're also going to refer to Michael Liu. How many of you know Michael Liu's work? Oh, wonderful. Okay, good. Because perhaps you can enlighten us a little as well. I've been going to a number of his, well, he's not here this time, but I have seen him present before. He's shared slide with us, and we've had some interaction with him. And the other thing we're going to talk about is models that work, because I'm involved right now in a book called Birth Models That Work. It's being co-edited by myself and Robbie Davis-Floyd, an anthropologist. How many of you know Robbie? Okay, a few fewer. Okay. And Leslie Barkley, who is an Australian midwife, and Jan Tritton, who runs Midwifery Today. So here we go. First of all, prior to the study that we put out in 2005, there was substantial literature on intended home births and midwife-attended births internationally and in North America. But the studies varied in quality, lacking size, national scope, or prospective methodology. There was consistent findings of low perinatal mortality among low-risk women giving birth at home or in a birth center with a midwife, with a few outliers. There was one outlier that was done in Washington State and one done in Australia, but the one done in Australia, we found out was only for, they had included lots of high risk, like breeches and twins, and so high risk, it turned out, was more dangerous, but low risk was not more dangerous at home. So what we did was, because we, do you want to talk to this at all, Ken, or am I going to go ahead? Okay. So what we did was we could not nationally find a direct comparison group because it's very difficult because the NIH does not collect data at the same level of detail that we do. But what we did do was we went to the out-of-hospital birth studies, all the studies that had more than 500 births in North America. And you can see it listed there. And you can see the neonatal and/or intrapartum mortality. It's very important to say and/or because that was one of the problems was looking at these studies. Sometimes they didn't include intrapartum in their data collection. So, what are you comparing? You're comparing like with like? No. So we went ahead. You can see the little stars there, minus intrapartum, some of these studies. And you can see one of the things that was happening was we could see at least the situation was getting better at home. It did seem that the stats were getting better as the years progressed. And this very last one down there you'll see was our study. The study we did do was the largest prospective home birth study that had ever been done when we got it published. So this was the cautionary note we had to our table about all of these studies. The table is presented for general comparison only. Direct comparison of relative mortality between individual studies is ill-advised, as many rates are unstable because of, number one, small number of deaths. Some of these studies were very small. Number two, study designs differed. Some of them were retrospective and some of them were prospective. The ability to capture and extract late neonatal mortality basically was very difficult in some. And there were significant differences, possibly where we weren't always sure, between the population studied, looking at socioeconomic status and a number of those factors. So we also looked at the international studies, which were quite reputable. This is the Australian study I was referring to. You see the 5.1 per thousand, but when you took out the high risk, it looked like it moved along similarly to the other out-of-hospital birth studies. So this was the eventual publication that we had. It's called Outcomes of Planned Home Births with Certified Professional Midwives. And as I say, it was the largest prospective home birth study that had been done to date. It was taking a defined group over a defined time period, which is what was needed, and it was national. And it was the outcomes of all the planned home births with certified professional midwives for 1 year, and that was the year 2000. And this will be a repeat for those of you who were with us earlier. This is one of the things that we discovered, is this incredible difference between the intervention rates of home women initiating their birth at home, and they could go into hospital obviously for cesarean section if that was necessary, it was deemed necessary. But look at these rates. Look at the yellow is the U.S. national average, and that was taken from this was from the Listening to Mothers survey, but we also compared it to the U.S. vital stats. And the red is the certified professional midwives. And you can see one of the most outstanding ones there is the C-section rate. Among the home birth women, it was 3.7%. And among even the low-risk hospital birth planned in hospital, it was 19%. There was quite a difference. So that was astounding. When we looked at the interpartum and neonatal mortality, do you want to discuss any of this, Ken? Ken is the epidemiologist. I talk faster sometimes.
Well, you don't have to talk fast today.
No? Okay, good.
We're in good
shape. We have more things to come up with, though.
We can serve cocktails at the end, you know.
Thank you, dear, for letting me have a chance to speak today. I didn't know if I was going to get one. When you do actually do a study, of course, you've got to look very carefully to see what are the causes of the deaths, the timing of the deaths, etc. Because if you just look crudely and say, oh my God, look at all those deaths. But if you look very carefully at it, they start to sort out generally into a number of categories that may have nothing to do with the location of the birth or the intended location of the birth. So among our 5,418 planned intended home births at the initiation of labor, we had four cases where the baby had already died before labor was initiated, but the woman decided she still wanted to have the birth at home. We had three cases where there were fatal birth defects that would, of course, had nothing to do with the place of birth. We had five intrapartum deaths, and things like the National Birth Certificate studies only look at live births, deaths among live births, so the intrapartum deaths would not be included. And then we had six neonatal deaths. So if you if you look at intrapartum and neonatal deaths only, that don't include the antenatal deaths or the intrapartum, you end up with two deaths per thousand. But among those, we also had what would be considered high risk by many midwives. We had numbers of breaches in twins, and a couple of the deaths were because of those. So when we remove the breaches in twins from both the numerator and the denominator, we end up with 1.7 deaths per 1,000 intended home births. And we concluded from that that planned home birth for low-risk women in North America using certified professional midwives associated with lower rates of medical intervention but similar intrapartum and neonatal mortality to that of low-risk hospital births in the United States. And the response of women and midwives was represented by the next slide, particularly pregnant women. But there were criticisms of the study, as there would be, of course, by the obstetrical profession in particular, that A, it was not a randomized controlled trial, but we've seen that that's just about impossible to do. Even in countries where home birth is well accepted, like the Netherlands and Britain, they both try and to do pilots for home birth, randomized trial of home versus hospital birth unsuccessfully. And then there's an argument that it's not a direct comparison. And in response to the not a direct comparison, we've done two things. First of all, we talked in our article about the Peter Schlenske study in California, where there is a direct comparison of data collected similarly, which we talked about in the earlier session, and are currently trying to get about to submit for publication.
Just before we get into our comparison, I wanted to tell you that one of the things that happened as we were looking at our direct comparisons, trying to figure out what, before we get into it, I thought, I'm so tired of, every time I hear about any study that somebody doesn't like, I thought, they always say you're comparing apples to oranges. And it's not just our study, it's everything. And I started looking, I started Googling, and I realized it's in every single profession. And I looked up an engineering, I looked up anything, and it's all, that's what always comes up, right? And it's a way, I think, of avoiding more sophisticated epidemiology. If you can't have a randomized control trial, you can't do anything. And what we're realizing more and more as we're looking at randomized control trials is not only can you not get a randomized control trial even in Holland, but you can't really, there is something about the way women choose to have their babies that really creates a systematic problem with doing that. And we have actually come to the conclusion, along with lots of the researchers in Britain, that a randomized control trial is not appropriate for place of birth. Because the people that have chosen not to, if anybody ever chose to be randomized and didn't really care where they were having their baby, they really would be an abnormal crowd. So it's a real, and there's something about the way women choose home birth that seems to be inherent in the birth outcome, and we think there is something about that, but we don't know how to explain it necessarily, as you'll see. But anyway, in the middle of my Google search, I found out that the science of comparing apples to oranges had actually taken a great leap, because they published in the PMJ this great article called Comparing Apples to Oranges, a Randomized Prospective Study, and their conclusion was apples and oranges are not only comparable but similar. And they went through great details. They've got graphs with apples cut in half when it gets to one half of the graph, and they show that they both are attacked by insects. They usually are grown in orchards. They have lots of, they are fruit. And there's lots of similarities, and that's what we realize we need to do. Whenever you are trying to do something more sophisticated, you need to do that. And then that's the very first line of this article. It's many authors who use the analogy of the putative inability to compare apples and oranges as a means of scornfully reviewing the work of others and dismissing it without looking through farther. So as Ken said, we have, and we presented in our earlier session about this new now older PhD thesis done by Peter Schlenske, which is a large defined prospective cohort of planned home and hospital births with similar low-risk files, which was a direct comparison. And the important thing for us is that it was from California, and California has 14% of the population of the United States. It's the largest state in the union, so it's a very, very important comparison to make. And I won't go into that in detail now because we did earlier. Since we've put out our study, there have been a few other home birth studies. The first two, there are one from Sweden, one from by the independent midwives in Britain. We've actually been involved with these studies to some extent. There are two Canadian studies out now. And the two Canadian studies are, by the way, direct comparisons. They're very interesting studies, and they turn out very similar data to ours. But one of the things we wanted to do is we realized that when we submitted for publication, we published the graph that you saw earlier that was a comparison group that we found that was a general comparison among singleton baby women who are not having twins, having one baby, women who are head down, that's vertex, and women who were having babies at term. And that's quite a respectable comparison as a general comparison. But after we submitted, the NIH provided vital stats that were a retrospective assessment of gestation. And they actually adjusted for different populations, which we thought was wonderful, and they also published the data for 2004 by gestational age and ethnic group, which we hadn't been able to access before. However, there was this infamous blogger that made a decision to attack our article because she had discovered this particular NIH data. And what she said was that the neonatal mortality for non-Hispanic whites at term for U.S. from birth certificates and infant death stats was 0.76 deaths, and ours was 1.7, and therefore we had double the risk. And at one point on another blog it said we had three times the risk. And our article has been attacked a fair number of times in the media and in different places, and especially by more recently the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. So but what we realized is this particular blogger was unaware of certain details. And so we thought, okay, well, we'll look at this new data that has turned up. And this is, by the way, not published, but we do have it on our website. So one of the things we realized is that our data set had both intrapartum and neonatal. It was not just neonatal, so there were a few extra deaths there. The other thing is that one of the deaths of the women in our population, one of the babies, we had no maternal deaths. One of the deaths was from a non-white Hispanic woman, one of the baby deaths. And there were three lethal anomalies that were, two of them were among the Amish, and one of them was an alternative health care provider, a chiropractor. And these three mothers chose not to have ultrasounds and also knew that even if they had an ultrasound, they would not terminate the pregnancy, even though it was a lethal anomaly. And we realized that looking at the data from other studies in the States, 80 to 90% of women will do that if they have a lethal anomaly. So we realized that was an outlier and we needed to remove those. And then there's also a natural decrease in neonatal mortality that hadn't been accounted for. So when all of that was done, and I'll let you talk to these next two slides.
So the point was that she had found this rate of 0.76 deaths per 1,000 among non-Hispanic whites with term live births and said, okay, ours is double or triple that. Well, we had argued from the beginning that you needed to remove the birth defects, and it's just a very different pattern of in the U.S. culture now. If you have a serious anomaly, there's about a 90% chance that you will have the baby terminated, which just isn't the case in our population, as Bidian has pointed out. At any rate, basically for the U.S. in 2000, we estimated that it would probably be about 0.91 deaths per 1,000 because that rate has been dropping over time. So we scaled it back up a little. And then you take again, we're starting with 14 deaths, but by the time you remove all of the ones that shouldn't be in there for a valid comparison, you end up with 5 deaths and 5,100 births for a neonatal mortality rate of 0.97 deaths per 1,000. So essentially identical risk in the two studies. More interestingly is in the course of looking at that data very carefully, and that's one thing I really like about scientific debate, is when people challenge you on stuff, it does challenge you to go and look more carefully. And when you look more carefully, you often discover remarkable things. What we did discover in the course of this was that, oh my God, in the same group of non-Hispanic white women, all these millions of birth certificates, that they actually had a much higher prematurity rate. In fact, it was 11.3% among non-Hispanic white women who went to full gestation. There was an 11.3% prematurity rate. I'm not sure if they went to term, but in our midwife group, the prematurity rate, based on our best estimates, was around 4 or 5%. So, of course, if you have women delivering prematurely, that's where the high-risk babies are going to end up as the prematures. they get eliminated because they're premature for the explicit comparison with the quote-unquote low-risk births of the home births, and you end up, again, just misleading yourself. But in terms of the Betty Ann's going to talk more about this prematurity issue, and it's fascinating because some other midwife studies have also found increased prematurity associated with non-midwifery care.
Right, so when we looked at the prematurity rates, we started thinking, okay, this isn't just choice of birthplace. And we started thinking, is it prenatal care? Is it continuity of care? And the reason we started thinking about continuity of care, because the certified professional midwives generally do continuity of care, which is that they have an ongoing investment in the women. They see them prenatally, they see them during the birth, they see them after the birth. So there's that continuous provider, as opposed to the fragmented system that happens in the States and Canada as well, where you women go to a woman to their physician, maybe their GP, for up to 5 months, and they go get shifted to an OB, and then they go to the hospital, and the OB, of course, is only on call once every 2 weeks, and so there's another OB, and then they're received by a nurse, and there's a postpartum nurse, and it's just very fragmented, and that's one of the reasons, actually, why midwives were legislated in Canada. So we spoke to some researchers in Britain, Sue Downs in particular, who said, oh, I think it's probably continuity of care, but since the last time we had the last APHA meeting, we actually did some more research, and we're not sure it is continuity of care. We've been talking with Jane Sandel in Britain, and she's not sure what that's about. So we turned to Michael Liu and started looking at the work that he's doing on the racial disparity, and looking at this, oh, that is really unfortunate. The actual, okay, what this slide shows, that you can't see the actual figures on there, but it basically shows that African American women represented in the blue block have about twice the prematurity that the women, the white women, which is represented by the red block, and African American women have almost three times the amount of very preterm births compared to the white women. And then if you look again, oh, this is really bad, this is even worse than that. Very far over to the left, that really tall white bar, what that's showing is the cause of infant death, and the white bar is prematurity due to prematurity, whereas the red bar is due to the birth defects. And all the from the Hispanic to the white, they almost all now have a larger a birth defect is really a high in terms of the reason for the infant mortality. But with African Americans, it's still prematurity. So then the question becomes, what's that about? So what Michael Liu has gone through is this whole series of questions. He looked at race, he looked at behavior, for instance, smoking. He looked at prenatal care, because we know that women of color are less likely to initiate early prenatal care or have adequate prenatal care. He looked at socioeconomic status. He looked at stress, infection, intra-pregnancy intervals, because among African Americans, there's less of a pregnancy interval, and perhaps they're just having their babies too close together. And then he looked at intergenerational factors, sibling and mother's weight, but also the grandfather's history. If the grandfather had a history of if there's slavery in the history of African American women, it's interesting. He thinks that's almost more of a determinant of whether this woman's birth outcome is going to be substantially impaired. And what he comes up with, what he came up with, is he started quoting Shiono. Do any of you know this work? This is the work that was done in 1997. What they did was they controlled for 46 risk factors of racial and ethnic disparities, looking at these multiple determinants of birth outcomes, and looking at all of those things, look at them all, demographic characteristics, medical risk, level of living, psychological concerns, and they still found, look down at the very last thing there, 46 factors explained less than 10% of the variation in birth weight between African Americans and whites, and there still remains this mean birth weight that's a different, and they can't, in other words, about 90%, they can't really explain. So what Michael Liu has come out with is he feels that we are just touching the surface by looking at prenatal care. He says, you know, your reproductive potential has something to do with when you're pregnant, but you can look at the pregnancy of a woman and you can look at how her nutrition is then, but you don't know what she ate all her through her life. You can look at her socioeconomic status during the pregnancy. She might be living in an apartment now, but you don't know if she has a history of poverty. You can look at a number of factors, but you don't know her whole history, and you certainly don't know her grandfather's history necessarily. And there was a session this morning on life course perspective, which has been developing out of Michael Liu's work, which would be very interesting for you all to follow up. It's fascinating to us. But here's the other study that he drew my attention to, and that is racial and ethnic disparities between, this is a study done, again, I'm sorry for the slide, but it's done between Mexicans that are living in the United States who identify as Mexicans and speak Spanish and who have not acculturated to the American way of life. And they compared those women to women who have been happy to put their Spanish aside and their whole culture, Mexican culture aside. And it's good maybe that this isn't labeled. So which do you think of these two bars are the ones that are Mexican and have retained their culture and retained their Spanish and whatnot? Which of them do you think is having more prematurity? Yeah, the lesser one.
11.
So what do you think that's
the not
acculturated, not acculturated.
Not acculturated.
Exactly.
So if you come tomorrow, Sylvia Gundemans calls that the paradox of immigrant care.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Yeah. So in the process of developing this book called Birth Models That Work, one of the models we looked at was the centering pregnancy model, which is something that we think is a particularly interesting model. And we think that probably the centering pregnancy model, by the way, let me go just to the next slide. Just so you know, they've actually done studies of the centering pregnancy. How many of you are familiar with centering pregnancy and what that is? Okay, great. Okay, so just to go back to this slide here, this is what they're doing. They take 8 to 12 women with similar gestational ages. They meet as a group with an obstetric provider. They have 10 sessions. Together they practice self-care skills. They participate in facilitated discussions, develop a support network with other group members. And then they do their clinical work in those. They're taken aside to have a little an exam, like behind a partition. But it's a unique model of care, and it really empowers women, and women really take charge of their pregnancy. And so among women in the study of the centering pregnancy, and they did do a randomized control trial, they found that with preterm births, those who received their prenatal care in a centering group gave birth on average 2 weeks later to babies and weight that weighed on average 1 pound more than their counterparts who received traditional prenatal care. So even though with Michael Liu's work, as I say, he's looking at prenatal care and he doesn't think it necessarily, we can do a lot with it, we can do something with it. And here, I worked actually in Alabama for several years when I was a young midwife in my 20s. And one of the things I noticed was, what did they do? During the time I was there, they removed the licenses of the African American granny midwives. And it wasn't based on clinical outcomes. I know that because I went with one of the physicians I worked with into the health department to look at the data. And they never asked the women. And it still tears my heart out that to see what happened to the African American births in the South. And I think it had, from what I understand now, it had more to do with the fact that Medicare came in and the physicians realized that they could actually make money on African women, whereas before, or African American women, before they couldn't. And when I went back up north, back to Canada, I could see the same thing was happening with the Inuit women. They were all being sent out. There was this huge evacuation starting in the 60s with Federal Medical Services, and it wasn't based on clinical outcome data, and they never asked the women. And when they did ask the women, they decided to rematriate birth up north, and it has resulted in better data. So there's something going on among communities that is very important. So when ACOG came out with their additional statement to their home birth statement that said childbirth decisions should not be dictated or influenced by what's fashionable, trendy, or the latest cause celeb, we looked at something else. We thought, what about the Amish? They're not exactly doing the latest cause celeb. And so there's something going on with the Amish. And I actually had an opportunity about a year and a half ago. I wanted to go to be with the Amish because my country, unfortunately, was the country, the home country that, how much time do I have?
About 6 minutes.
Okay, I'll do it. The term breach trial was initiated in Toronto, Canada, and I don't know if you know about the term breach trial, but the original preliminary data made, in that preliminary data, it appeared that it was safer to have babies delivered by cesarean section instead of vaginally. 2 years later, they looked at the data of the babies that were born, that had some negative sequela, and they redid the calculations, and they realized that there was really no significant difference between cesarean and vaginal birth. And in the interim, of course, everybody around the world had changed to doing cesarean section for almost all vaginal births. And when the new data came out, they did not change back. So I went to the Amish because I wanted to see how they were doing births. I went to Norway, I went to Germany, I went to a number of places, and the Amish are still doing breaches at home. So I wanted to see what they were doing, and I ended up meeting this woman by the name of Diane Goslin, who I don't know if Shannon even is familiar with, but she's in Lancaster County. And are you familiar with this case? No? Okay. Anyway, she'd been a midwife for 26 years, and she was part of the CPM 2000 study, so I wanted to meet her. I wanted to see how they were doing their births. And unbeknown to me, a few months after I left, she was actually given a cease and desist order. And this was the same community where that had just been struck by the these terrible tragedy of the schoolhouse killings that most of you probably know about. She had actually done the birth for some of these children. But the Amish community is an amazing, amazing community. They showed support to the very woman who was the wife of the man that killed those children. And they set up a fund for her and for her children, which just shows you what the Amish do. And in the middle of all this, a nurse midwife put in a complaint against Diane. And in Canada, we don't have nurse midwives, and then certified professional midwives, and then lay midwives, and all these different types of midwives. And so for me, I thought this was going to set up a very difficult precedent, and you can see there a little bit about Diane's practice. She does do breaches at home. She's had no breach deaths or morbidity in the 130 to 140 done. That doesn't necessarily mean she's not going to. We can't tell from that number, you know, how well she's doing really, but you can see that what it costs for a birth in the hospital for the Amish, and why they want to retain her, and. And the other thing is, in a hospital, the Amish woman's only choice is to have a cesarean section. So Diane didn't think they were going to get a lot of support, but almost 1,000 Amish came up to Harrisburg, to the capital, to support their midwife. It was an incredible situation. And only 250 people fit into the court. They had seven judges, all judges from all sections of the Commonwealth, in Philadelphia. And one of the things that I took down as notes is that Diane was actually up against the State Medical Board and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And this is just one of the things that I wrote down as they were bringing their testimony. ACOG stood up and they said, well, since 1911, the State Medical Board really has been in charge of licensing. And then one of the judges said, well, that is what we're here to judge. And then the second judge said, well, you're suggesting you need a PhD or something. And then the third judge said, I thought the reason midwives were useful is they had a hands-on approach and developed a relationship with the women. And what's amazing is that Diane won this case. And for me, as a Canadian citizen, I thought, there really is something to the American legal system. I think the judges really did see that there's, you know, to put in a complaint against a woman who's serving the Amish is like going fast nowhere. Going nowhere fast. And I really think that that's something we need to be looking at, is we need to be looking at other reasons for why things are going on here, and we don't have all the answers today. I'm just saying to you, we know about prematurity. We know that something's happening among women who have home birth. They have lower prematurity. So is it choice of birthplace? Is it prenatal care? Is it culture? Is it values? Is it trust in caregivers? Is it empowerment? family histories have enabled the women to make the choice to have a home birth. Is that what's going on? Because I'm looking at Michael Liu's work and I'm thinking, maybe, why is it the women choose home birth? Does it have something to do with the fact that they feel they have enough confidence to do that? And what gives them that confidence? So here's our conclusions. Neonatal mortality is similar to hospital birth, home births. Neonatal mortality is similar to hospital birth. Prematurity and intervention rates are lower, and we don't know why. And this is where you can go. Sure. And this is where you can go for more information. We have a lot of this information on our database, on our website, which is at understandingbirthbetter.com. And we also have the APHA resolution there. But the other thing you might want to do is go to the booth. It's six. What is it, Carol? To 1602, booth 1602. Carol Nelson is at that booth, and she can give you a lot of the information from here. We have a few handouts here, but we found out it was going to cost a huge amount to photocopy here, so we just have a few pages. All right. That's all.
Any questions?
Yes, doctor. Because maternal outcomes, in this particular study? Well, we do actually have, in this actual study, we didn't talk about it here. It's just, this is a nuance of what we've already done, because that study was published in 2005. And by the way, you can go to it through this, you can just type in bmj.com or go to our website. But it's free on the web, because the British Medical Journal at that time was still allowing articles to go out freely. And it's been downloaded over 100,000 times. And with the new Ricky Lake film out, with the new Ricky Lake film and Orgasmic Birth, it's being accessed even more. It's going up. It's incredible. But that's why. We do have some information about maternal morbidity. But one of the interesting things about that is we've been looking a lot at the Optimality Index, which is the new way of looking at what is optimal for birth, which hopefully is good outcomes combined with less intervention. But at the time we did this publication, we really felt that we still needed to get this the perinatal mortality settled, because we felt that we needed that large study across the nation of home birth women. Yes. Well, what I'm proposing it as a question, actually, because the thing is, we actually just incidentally, by accident, came upon the fact that there seems to be less prematurity. So then I started looking at other people who have been discussing prematurity, and we decided to look at Michael Liu's work because he's really advanced in his process, in his thinking process about what causes it. And I realized we couldn't just stop at, it's continuity of care and prenatal care, and obviously women are just feeling more cared for or something, or something's making them comfortable enough that they can keep that baby in there. Who knows? So that's why I went to him. But what I am really starting to wonder about is why women choose home birth. Why is it that certain women feel comfortable to do that, and why do other women not? And interestingly, we did do this comparison we have here is non-white Hispanic women who have hospital birth compared to non-white Hispanic women who have home birth, and we see that
Hispanic white women.
Thank you. and we find that it's lower. So the question is, one of the questions that's come up for me actually is, there are not a lot of African American women that choose home birth, and why? But it's just, I really am wondering that's the connection. But also just trying to look at what it is that causes prematurity. Period.
It's also good. There's more.
Yes.
They compared women who deliver in a hospital with an in-life versus women who deliver at home with an in-life.
We haven't done that, but somebody who has done that is Judith Fullerton, and she put out a study with Richard Severino, and they did it looking at about six states. It was Alaska. I can't remember all of the states. And it's been done in Canada as well. I think the man back there had his hand up before. Yeah.
I just want to make it very clear that most nurse midwives in this country are very, very supportive of homework and advocates of homework. Judith Fullerton, a good friend of mine, is
yes.
a nurse.
We work with her, yeah. Yeah.
I just want to make it clear that it's unfortunate when that happens, but we don't need to be divisive and working against each other. I've seen that happen so much. We're all midwives. Maybe some of us doing a little bit different things, taking care of the big picture, but we're all working together.
Yes, thank you for that comment. I think it's well taken. Yeah.
I guess I'd just like to say, one of the things that we've worked very, very hard through APHA, through this particular section, this particular committee, is to go through that. And that in the long run, it's the families and the mothers and the babies that we're all here about. And as a family physician, who had to leave family practice because I was supporting midwives and was told by other family physicians that since OB wouldn't support us, why should we support the midwives? I mean, this is crazy, guys. We're all here on the same team, and we're really not the major part of the team. The teams are the families, the childbearing families. So we're just, the hired help, so to speak. So I really appreciate that. I'm sure that in Betty's presentation, I'm sure she's more of a shock value. Can you believe it wasn't even a doc, but am I wrong?
Well, it just in Canada we don't have this issue.
So
it's shock value. So I give you, I think that's appropriate. Is there any other questions for any of the panel members? Well, guys, I think we're ending a little early, which gives you some time to get done. I have two things to remind you of real quickly. There is a committee meeting that's going to be at 6:30 at 27A. If you do not have time to go, if you would please tell Carol anything that you're interested in seeing or doing next year, because we have to put out a call. And then tomorrow, the Martha May Elliott Forum is talking about immigration and its impact on maternal and child outcomes. Health outcomes, and we have an absolutely stellar panel. So it's at 2:30 in 28D, which is the room next door, and you're welcome to come to the Martha May Elliott lunch, and if you don't have a ticket, try to get one. If not, you can come anyway and hear Jonathan Koch speak. I'm sure Jonathan is the winner, and I'm sure his reflections will be something that people don't want to miss. So thank you all for your attendance. The luncheon is at 12:30 in room 3, and I'm not sure if there are tickets, but there are places to come and sit along the line of the side, and I'll have to tell you that folks, if there are places at the table, I usually fill people in. So on that note,
can I just tell?
Yes.
We have a couple of handouts. One is a summary of this extended analysis of our BMJ study comparing to the live birth data that we were talking about. We also have another piece that's about 5 pages that answers 7 or 8 questions that have come up about our study and why we did or didn't do stuff, why we published it in a certain spot. And those are available there or on our website.
Any other? Shannon or Mark? Folks, thank you very, very much for coming, and thank you for continuing to support innovations and remembering, please everybody keep your mind that normal birth is what it's all about. Thank you. I have to go run off, but I'm worse than that. I have to change clothes.
Yeah. Now, here's this is the summary front page for the answers to the questions. This is the front page for the press release. If you want
calls, well, the actual, it depends on the thing. Your question about why do women choose? Of course, they have some of their cultural background before they put their trust.
Thank you so much. Very, very, very. I'm not an American or English, but I happen to live near the area, and I'm been aware of the treatment of women. And
I'm very
racist that you're something that has made remarkable gains of their faith in order to have the skills as a midwife. Women are not supposed to be educated within the Amish faith. And I'm trying to describe what really happened with the judges.
This was in Pennsylvania, this is Hartsburg. Mm-hmm. It was very interesting, because I was up in Hartsburg, and that's why I wrote down what the judge said. I was amazed that they did that. But I think that because it was incredible, we went in, we were supposed to be, our hearing was supposed to be at 9:30. It was actually a Supreme Court hearing, because she had had an original, I mean, there's lots of the story there. There was an original cease and desist done in October. She had $18,000 to make an endowment for her. Then, but you see, ACOG has unedited. And so they added to her. And the state medical board said what they said, that no, they covered things that they don't know. They actually said to the first primary judge, they said, well, you're there's not a discussion here that really should just provide a light for us, and that is that they just really have no right to be practicing at all. They don't get medical board in charge of medicine.
That's
and that's what the judge went, well, who do you think you are?
That's right, that's what Donna judge of.
Yeah.
And that's what saved her.
Yeah. But she, you know, she had to sell 10 acres of her land. She had a $100,000 bill. And she can't afford to go to court again. They took her to court about 10 or 15 years ago, over a similar issue. It wasn't, it was over the cycle, somebody came to complain and they were just wanted to get rid of her. So surprised.
It's not an area where it has
not even a high margin. I'm sure you always do. Yes.
Did you get your sheet here?
Thank you.
former town president of health and Shampshire, she's coming out there.
Is that Maggie or is that Carrie Sparrow?
Carrie, yeah, Carrie is my neighbor, my old hometown, yeah. Carrie and Tosi Marcellin and all those folks. They were, yeah, Carrie's from my town. Yeah, she's also fun.
We don't actually know Carrie, just have a connection with her. She wanted to
go. She's still working with us, but she's been doing
good. Oh, that's really interesting stuff because she was interested in that stuff. That's really cool.
Yeah, yeah, she's doing wonderful work.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we started in a small world, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it is a very small world. Well, and wonderful.
I know. I love it. I'm all that, but it's like, what? Yeah. I just.
You know what I'm teaching, and I still don't know.
Yeah, there's another.
quite successful.